scrutinized, pondered, and tested for years to come. Kennedy didn't want to undergo interrogation. He said, "If the court would permit me, I would like to be able to relate to the court the immediate period following the time that Mr. Gargan, Markham, and I got back in the car." Neither Boyle nor Denise had any objection. "I believe it was about 45 minutes after Gargan and Markham dove, and they likewise became exhausted, and no further diving efforts appeared to be of any avail. And they so indicated to me, and I agreed," Kennedy said. "So they came out of the water and came back into the car and said to me, at different times as we drove down the road towards the ferry, that it was necessary to report this accident. A lot of different thoughts came into my mind at that time, about how I was going to really be able to call Mrs. Kopechne at some time in the middle of the night, to tell her that her daughter was drowned, to be able to call my own mother and my own father, my wife," Kennedy said, evading the issue of notifying the police and rescue personnel. "Even though I knew that Mary Jo Kopechne was dead, and believed firmly that she was in the back of that car, I willed that she remained alive. I was almost looking out the windows, trying to see her walking down that road." Gargan and Markham understood this feeling, but said it was necessary all the same to report the accident. "And about this time we came to the ferry crossing. And I got out of the car and we talked there just a few minutes," Kennedy continued. "I just wondered how all of this could possibly have happened. I also had sort of a thought and the wish and desire and the hope that suddenly this whole accident would disappear. I related this to Gargan and Markham, and they reiterated that this had to be reported, and I understood at the time that it had to be reported. And I had full intention of reporting it. And I mentioned to Gargan and Markham something like, 'You take care of the girls, I will take care of the accident.' That is what I said, and I dove into the water." Kennedy had been prompted to give instructions not to alarm Mary Jo's friends that night, and conceal the accident from the others at the party, "because I felt strongly that if these girls were notified that an accident had taken place, and Mary Jo had, in fact, drowned, that it would only be a matter of seconds before all of those girls, who were long and dear friends of Mary Jo's, would go to the scene of the accident and enter the water with, I felt, a good chance that some serious mishap might have occurred to any one of them." With that admonition, Kennedy dove into the channel. As he started to swim into the tide, "I felt an extraordinary shove, the water almost pulling me down. And I suddenly realized that I was in a weakened condition, although as I had looked over that distance between the ferry slip and the other side, it seemed to me an inconsequential swim. But the water got colder, and the tide began to draw me out, and for the second time that evening I knew I was going to drown." Kennedy said, "I remember being swept down toward the direction of the Edgartown light and well out into the darkness. And I tried to swim at a slower pace, to be able to regain whatever kind of strength that was left in me. And some time after that, I think it was about the middle of the channel, the tide was much calmer, gentler. Reaching the other shore, he pulled himself onto a beach. He said, 'And all the nightmares and all the tragedy and all the loss of Mary Jo's death was right before me again.'" Kennedy found his way to a parking lot adjacent to the Shiretown Inn. Almost having no further strength to continue, and leaning against a tree for a length of time, trying to really gather some kind of idea as to what happened. He went to his room, took off his clothes, and collapsed on the bed. He was conscious of a throbbing headache, pains in his neck, and back strain. But what I was even more conscious of was the tragedy and loss of a very devoted friend, Kennedy added. Hearing noises around me, on top of me, almost in the room, Kennedy put on dry clothes and opened the door to his room. I saw what I believed to be a tourist or someone standing under the light off the balcony and asked what time it was. He mentioned to me it was, I think, 2:30, and I went back into the room. He said, and betrayed the guile and calculation of his prepared testimony. In his television speech, Kennedy had specifically identified a room clerk. Russell Peachey had corroborated the conversation the next day. Now, in the lawyer reworked version, it was more prudent not to be so exact following his dramatic swim, as to appear to suggest a motive in seeking a witness to his presence far from the accident scene. Kennedy also neglected to say he had descended the stairs to provoke the encounter, or that the tourist had asked if he required any further assistance. Denise did not ask why Kennedy had not availed himself of this opportunity to report the accident. By his rambling discourse, Kennedy had avoided explaining why authorities had not been notified of the accident, or help sought to retrieve the body of Mary Jo Kopechne from his submerged car. "I never really went to bed that night," Kennedy continued. "Even as that night went on, and as I almost tossed and turned and walked around that room, I had not given up hope all night long that, by some miracle, Mary Jo would have escaped from the car." Kennedy had spoken to the desk clerk the next morning, then to Ross Richards and Stan Moore. He had been able to conduct these conversations without betraying any sign of distress about the accident, Kennedy explained in 1974 to the Boston Globe. "Because I was still in the frame of mind of false hope, that perhaps with the dawning of a new day, all the nightmare events of the evening before would have been washed away. But all hope absolutely disappeared when Gargan and Markham arrived at the Shiretown Inn," Kennedy said. "From just the look on their faces, I could tell that as hard as I had prayed for survival, that Mary Jo was dead. Up to that time, I really tried to will her existence and her life. They asked, had I reported the accident, and why I hadn't reported the accident," Kennedy said on the witness stand. "I told them about my own thoughts and feelings as I swam across that channel, that somehow, when they arrived in the morning, that they were going to say that Mary Jo was still alive. I told them how I somehow believed that when the sun came up and it was a new morning, that what had happened the night before would not have happened and did not happen. And how I just couldn't gain the strength within me, the moral strength, to call Mrs. Kopechne at 2 o'clock in the morning and tell her that her daughter was dead." But Kennedy conceded he did make a private phone call to one of the dearest and oldest friends I have, Burke Marshall. "I didn't feel that I could use the public phone that was available outside the dining room at the Shiretown Inn, the same one he used to attempt to reach Stephen Smith, calling a party that I felt would know the number." Denise didn't ask who the party was. Kennedy didn't volunteer he'd called Helga Wagner. Note: 5 years later, Kennedy was still avoiding disclosure of who he had called, telling the Boston Globe he tried to reach Stephen Smith, "and I was unable to." "Who did you call?" "I think it's in the testimony," Kennedy said. Asked again, "Who did you call?" Kennedy replied, "A number of... he was in Spain at the time, and I tried to call someone to get the number." "Do you remember who that was?" "I would have to check on it, I think," Kennedy said. Not until 1980 did Kennedy reveal he'd called family friend Helga Wagner. After repeated denials, Mrs. Wagner confirmed the senator had called her on the morning after the accident. She said he was trying to find a number for Stephen Smith. He had returned to Chappaquiddick and called Burke Marshall. "Because it was my thought that once I went to the police station, I would be involved in a myriad of details, and I wanted to talk to this friend before I undertook that responsibility." Kennedy then returned to Edgartown with the intention of reporting the accident. "But you didn't go directly from your hotel room to the police," Denise began to challenge the logic of the testimony. But Boyle interrupted to say, "Excuse me, Mr. Denise, we are now at 1 o'clock. I think we will take the luncheon recess." It was the second time during Kennedy's testimony that Boyle had rescued him from dangerous questions. Kennedy didn't seem confident of what he was saying on the witness stand, Assistant District Attorney Peter Gay observed. In his experience as a trial lawyer, you can pick out those witnesses that are positive and assured, and Senator Kennedy impressed me that he wasn't. Whether it was his position, his status in life, he was insecure about what he was trying to say. Senator Kennedy returned to the house on School Street for a salad and sandwich lunch with his lawyers. Kennedy's state of mind had been insufficiently explained to account for his failure to report the accident, and to seek further assistance to rescue Mary Jo Kopechne as mitigation for the omission to act liability for manslaughter under the Wolanski decision. The subject of alcoholic beverages had been introduced, but not aggressively pursued. Kennedy hadn't been asked about the victory party on board the Betterwin, a point that had to be covered since Ross Richards was scheduled to testify. A fuller statement emphasizing Kennedy's sobriety was needed to head off that element of manslaughter showing up as probable cause for negligence in Boyle's inquest report. Miller, acting on information from Bernie Flynn, assured Kennedy that Richards was not going to testify about drinking. From his examination, Denise appeared to be verifying Flynn's intelligence that no bombs were going to be dropped at the inquest. Still, Kennedy had some rough moments left when he resumed the witness stand at 2 o'clock. Denise quoted from Kennedy's accident report. "When I fully realized what had happened this morning, I immediately contacted the police," Denise asked. "Now is that, in fact, what you did?" Once again, Boyle moved to the rescue. "Mr. Kennedy already said this was a copy of the statement he made. Now won't you let the record speak for itself?" Faced with repeated sabotage of his examination, Denise finally exploded. "Well, I don't think it's possible, Your Honor, at this late date in my life, to begin to change whatever style I have and the method of cross-examination." "There is no cross-examination in this inquest," Boyle pounced. "We don't need constant repetition of testimony." "I know we don't need it, but we have to have it occasionally," Denise said, furious. "I appreciate it, and I apologize to the court." Clearly, Denise was not going to be allowed to pursue the inconsistencies between the police report and Kennedy's television speech. Boyle simply blocked testing of testimony through reiteration, a trial technique Boyle wanted no part of in the inquest. Frustrated, Denise had no further questions. Neither did Boyle. He wanted to know if Kennedy would be available in the event we needed you back for anything. Kennedy would make himself available. But he couldn't resist reminding the court he was, after all, a United States senator. He said, "I would hope to be able to return to Washington sometime this week." But so inadequate had his examination been, even Kennedy was dissatisfied with it. The record would show he'd been let off the hook too easily. Before he was released, Kennedy asked to consult his attorneys on one point that I might like to address the bench on. Whether Boyle wanted repetition of testimony or not, he was going to get it. Kennedy wanted another run at the key question of the inquest. "Why did you not seek further assistance after Mr. Markham and Mr. Gargan had exhausted their efforts in attempting to reach Mary Jo?" Kennedy said, "It is because I was completely convinced at that time that no further help and assistance would do Mary Jo any more good. I realized that she must be drowned and still in the car. And it appeared the question in my mind at that time was, what should be done about the accident?" Since the alcoholic intake is relevant, Kennedy wanted to clarify the other element of manslaughter to which he was the most vulnerable. "Although I haven't been asked it, I feel in all frankness and fairness and for a complete record that it should be included as part of the proceedings." During the course of the regatta race, Kennedy had shared 2 beers with members of his crew. A one other occasion in which there was some modest intake of alcohol would be after the race at the slip in which Ross Richards' boat was moored. He said, "I shared a beer with Mr. John Driscoll. The sum and substance of that beer would be, I think, less than a quarter of one." That gratuitous falsehood could be dropped into the record thanks to Bernie Flynn's assurance neither Richards nor Stan Moore were prepared to testify to the 3 rum and cokes Kennedy had imbibed at the party. "Anything more?" Boyle said. Having delivered himself of testimony prepared by his attorneys to explain the various inexplicable, inconsistent, and inconclusive things I said and did after the accident, Kennedy couldn't think of anything else to say. He came out of the courthouse looking immensely relieved, and for the first time since the accident, he again was the breezy and smiling, supremely self-confident Ted Kennedy. His 3 hours of testimony had generally paralleled his two previous statements about the accident, Kennedy told reporters shivering in the 26-degree cold outside. I'm satisfied I responded in the most complete way possible to all the questions put to me by the judge and the district attorney. Kennedy wanted his testimony released as soon as possible, perhaps within days of the conclusion of the inquest, he said. I expect to be vindicated, and vindicated fully, when the transcript is made public, and I am then allowed to answer questions. Kennedy enjoyed an escort of reporters to the house on School Street, all shouting questions at once. One of them asked, "Who else testified, Senator?" Kennedy replied, "Now, you don't expect me to give away any secrets, do you?" Chapter 50. A summary of Senator Kennedy's testimony was dictated by Clark and Hanafy to Joe Donegan, a recital by necessity foreshortened, because how much could they take down in longhand of what he said in the courtroom, Donegan said later. It was no substitute for a transcript. Donegan did not know why such a record was being made of inquest testimony, in contravention of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court's ruling on secrecy. But, surrounded by lawyers, Donegan wasn't concerned about the legality of his assignment. The only testimony they were interested in getting was the people that were at the party. The average take was a couple of pages, if that much. It didn't take me very long. It was just an outline of their testimony. Very meager, really. But it was sufficient to provide a working script to keep succeeding witnesses on the track of the senator's testimony, and prevent anything contrary to it from getting into the inquest record Boyle wanted kept secret. The judge had gone so far to ensure that, as to demand the stenographic notes of official court stenographers, Sidney Lipman and Harold McNeil, be destroyed after daily transcription was accomplished. When Lipman protested the transcript might not be official without his original notes, should he later be called upon to recheck what had been said in the courtroom, Boyle agreed to have the tapes impounded rather than destroyed. But no matter how hard the Kennedy legal team tried to shape the outcome of the inquest, risks remained. Ray LaRosa came close to placing the credibility of the senator's testimony in serious jeopardy. A former fireman employed by the Federal Office of Civil Defense, LaRosa testified that he had not seen Senator Kennedy leave the party with Mary Jo Kopechne. He wasn't sure what time a voice which I recognized as Senator Kennedy's had called out his name twice outside the cottage. After Gargan and Markham left the party, LaRosa had gone for a walk with Nance and Mary Ellen Lyons. A car coming from the direction of the ferry had stopped. A man asked whether we needed help or something, and one of the girls made some kind of statement. I think she said, "Shove off," or something of that nature, LaRosa said. Before that occurrence, however, another car had come along heading toward the ferry in the same direction LaRosa was walking, he said. And I held my hands out to kind of protect the two girls. The car slowed down and didn't stop and just continued on its way. That LaRosa had seen another car between the cottage and the intersection, at the same time one was observed there by Huck Look, was a revelation that could explode the senator's testimony about the time the accident had taken place. Distressed when he later realized the significance of the other car, LaRosa said, "Hell, it could clear Kennedy once and for all if I told you it wasn't his old's, but I really can't say." But the bomb LaRosa dropped on the inquest didn't detonate to any effect. Neither Denise nor Boyle pursued the subject of the other car. LaRosa's testimony inflicted only minimal damage on Kennedy's story. "The lawyers coached us pretty good," he said later. "We knew what to expect." A young Boston attorney and Kennedy campaign aide, Charles Tretter, also grazed the senator's testimony. Tretter told the inquest he had not seen the senator and Mary Jo Kopechne leave the party, but became aware of their absence around 11:30 p.m., when he went for the first of two walks with Rosemary Keough. He said, "I had to go by where two cars were parked. There was only one car, the white Valiant. During the walk, it had been necessary for Tretter to step off the road for passing automobiles, one of which he thought was the Valiant. He'd returned to the cottage between 30 to 40 minutes later, and there was no one there, no cars. Tretter assumed party guests had returned to Edgartown without him. But Tretter had walked into a time trap. Had the accident occurred when Senator Kennedy said it did, and had he returned to the cottage at 12:15 a.m. to fetch Gargan and Markham, Kennedy would have encountered Tretter and Keogh on their walk toward the intersection. Kennedy later acknowledged it was unlikely he could have missed anyone on so narrow a road. But the contradiction in Senator Kennedy's testimony wasn't pursued. Judge Boyle adjourned the first day of the inquest at 4 p.m. As he was to remind all witnesses, Boyle warned Tretter not to discuss his testimony with anyone except his lawyer, and particularly with no other witnesses. Tretter resumed the witness stand the next day. He hadn't known about the accident, or that Senator Kennedy had called Joe Gargan and Paul Markham out of the cottage, until Saturday morning. Tretter said, "Mr. Gargan said the senator was distraught, that neither one of them talked to him. He just kept saying, 'Get me to Edgartown, get me to Edgartown.'" It was clear from his testimony that Tretter hadn't been paying much attention to anything but Rosemary Keogh that weekend. When it was her turn to testify, Keogh stumbled badly with regard to time, finding it difficult to keep in mind the hour and a half differential between the senator's version of the accident and that of Huck Look. Keogh thought it was 12:15 a.m. or 12:30 when she left the cottage for her first walk with Tretter. Returning to the cottage some 45 minutes later, she found the place empty, except for Jack Crimmins asleep in the bedroom. Keogh had resumed her promenades with Tretter for another hour and a half. By the time she returned to the cottage again, people were settling down to sleep. Keogh had seen the senator and Mary Jo leave the party at 11:20 p.m., having looked at Susan Tannenbaum's watch. But despite her avowal in August to answer all questions fully and cooperatively, she had little else to say. "As far as I'm concerned," she said later, "there's only one person who really knows what happened from the beginning of the incident to the end. And that's Edward Kennedy." But Keogh and Tretter were suffering a problem unique to Kennedy witnesses. Having gone to the Shiretown Inn to borrow a radio, danced together at the party, disappeared for two midnight walks lasting over 2 hours, and slept side by side on the living room floor, it was clear a flirtation had blossomed during the weekend. Tretter's wife was reported furious at the episode of dalliance, Paul Redmond said. In preparing Tretter's testimony, it was Dan Daly's idea to keep him walking, to save his marriage. Having to account for his own activities didn't leave Tretter much time to verify Kennedy's story, or contribute significantly to the transcript Donegan was making at the inquest. But the transcript was not only serving as an aide-memoir for witnesses, but as a means of exerting control over them by lawyers, whose main interest was Ted Kennedy, Esther Newberg recognized. Every witness knew what they said in the courtroom was going on the private record, sure to inhibit any spontaneous deviation from that script on the witness stand. The procedure was devised by Jack Miller, who reported on the progress of the inquest to Stephen Smith from one of 5 telephones installed at the house on School Street. So tightly was control being exercised, the Boiler Room girls excused from testifying at the second day's inquest session were not allowed to leave the courthouse unsupervised. Lawyer Paul Redmond asked Judge Boyle for permission to leave the courtroom, just to escort them by the press outside, he said. They have to pass reporters with microphones. As the second day of the inquest progressed, attention centered on Joe Gargan and Paul Markham, the lawyer friends, as Newsweek observed, who, though not suffering from shock, had joined Kennedy in his long post-accident silence. Their testimony was second only to Kennedy's in interest. In many ways, Gargan and Markham had more to clarify than Senator Kennedy, since they were presumably lucid when Kennedy returned to the cottage dazed after his accident. Not only would they be asked about Kennedy's activities, but their own, particularly why neither had summoned help to the scene or reported the accident to police. As the only witnesses who could corroborate Kennedy's post-accident behavior, they could be expected to be the target of Denise's most probing questions. Gargan said he wasn't worried. I was simply going to tell what I saw, and what I did, and what I heard. Gargan did far better than that. Building on his image as bag carrier and factotum projected by the press, Gargan played it for all it was worth on the witness stand. He poured out a torrent of irrelevant details about the sailing weekend, even to describing his role as crew during the regatta race. Having to hold on to the stay, forcing my back out in this position with the pole holding the spinnaker out. Gargan even larded his testimony with details of culinary techniques he had employed at the cookout. Chatty as a neighbor exchanging recipes across a backyard fence, Gargan explained, "I took out of the refrigerator what you would call frozen hors d'oeuvres, some which have sausage and some which had cheese. I turned the oven to about 450 degrees. They take about 12 minutes to cook. And I put in some of these hors d'oeuvres at that time. After they were ready, I took them out and started to pass them around." Denise later confessed he had been disarmed and amused in spite of himself, and regaled his staff with Gargan's testimony. Eddie was laughing during a call to Jimmy Smith during the inquest. He thought it was hysterical about the oven temperature and all the cooking instructions. Between working at the kitchen stove and the grill outdoors, Gargan said he hadn't noticed which guests at the party were drinking or how much. The senator was holding a tall glass with a dark fluid in it. I would say it was Coca-Cola. Whether there was anything else in the glass besides Coca-Cola, I cannot honestly testify to, Gargan said. But I would say, frankly, that the senator does consume rum and coke, and I would assume he was drinking rum and coke at that time. Kennedy left the party between 11:25 p.m. and 11:30 p.m. I saw him go out the door of the cottage with Mary Jo Kopechne. Where he went from there, I don't know. Gargan assumed they were going to the ferry because of a conversation the senator had joined in with Jack Crimmins prior to his leaving. "Mr. Crimmins was somewhat agitated by the fact that we weren't moving out," Gargan said. Crimmins had complained that it was 11:15 and that we ought to think about leaving because the last ferry left at 12 o'clock. Gargan did not mention Crimmins urging him to get these douchebags out of here, or his state of intoxication. "I didn't think it was necessary to testify to that," he said later. The gist of the conversation was that Jack wanted everybody to go home. Gargan testified he next saw Senator Kennedy in the back seat of the Valiant when Kennedy announced, "The car has gone off the bridge down by the beach and Mary Jo is in it." Gargan drove, just as fast as I could, to the accident scene. When attempts to rescue Mary Jo failed, I didn't think there was anything more that could be done. The senator had been very emotional, extremely upset, very disturbed, Gargan said. He told me he was going down the dirt road headed toward I don't know what. He suddenly saw the bridge in front of him and that was it. He went right off into the water. Gargan couldn't testify to the dialogue word for word, but I do recall that the thrust of the conversation, and I was the one who said it, was that we have got to make a report of the accident immediately. Before the senator did so, however, Gargan suggested he call David Burke to let the family know he was all right, and Burke Marshall, because Burke Marshall is the best lawyer I know. The senator told him to go back to the party. "Don't upset the girls, don't get them involved," and dove into the water. Gargan watched him swim until he was about three-quarters of the way across, confident of his ability to make it to the other side. The senator can swim that 5 or 6 times both ways. Gargan said he then drove to the cottage, turned the car around, and returned to the landing. He decided the senator was going to report the accident. Following the senator's instructions, Gargan said nothing about the accident when he returned to the cottage around 2:15 a.m. Quick arithmetic would have revealed Gargan's timing didn't jibe with Senator Kennedy's. Had the rescue efforts taken approximately 45 minutes from the time Kennedy said he had returned to the cottage to seek help, around 12:15 a.m., that would have placed him at the landing at 1 o'clock. Gargan had left more than an hour unaccounted for. Given the difficulty of tracking such vague testimony, Denise did not pick up on the time discrepancy, asking only about the time the senator had left the cottage. Denise did not ask Gargan if the senator had been in shock after the accident, or what excuse Kennedy had offered the following morning when Gargan learned the accident had not been reported. Gargan had seen the sheet of paper the senator was working on his report at the police station, but hadn't read it or mentioned being at the accident scene to Chief Arena, he said. I never spoke to the police, not about that or anything else. Despite the widely published speculation that Gargan had agreed to take the blame for the accident, Denise failed to ask if the senator had proposed the alternative scenario Gargan had carefully edited out of his 1 hour of testimony. Gargan was prepared to say, yes, that was discussed, but not acted upon. Denise had spared him the necessity. For all of his outrageous garrulousness, Gargan walked off the witness stand in triumph, neither having betrayed Ted Kennedy nor having committed perjury. If Paul Markham couldn't match Gargan's performance, he did comport himself well on the witness stand. Kennedy had a rum and coke with me before the other guests had arrived, but Markham did not know how much more the senator had to drink at the party, nor did he expressly recall Kennedy leaving at any specific time. By Markham's best estimate, it was shortly after 12 o'clock that Kennedy returned to the cottage seeking help to rescue Mary Jo Kopechne at Dyke Bridge. We were singularly unsuccessful in trying to get into the car. The current was very, very strong, Markham said. The girl was apparently gone. We had to get help and report the accident. En route to the landing, Markham observed the senator to be very emotional. He was sobbing and almost on the verge of actually breaking down crying. Kennedy had said the next morning he hadn't reported the accident. Because, I don't know, it was just a nightmare. I wasn't even sure it happened. As Fernandez understood Markham's testimony, the reason that you or Mr. Gargan did not seek assistance or notify the police was that you assumed that Mr. Kennedy was going to do so when he arrived in Edgartown after the swim? That is what he told us, Markham said, truthfully. The two witnesses, who besides Kennedy have the most explaining to do, had gotten cleanly away. Unlike Senator Kennedy, both had testified without knowing in advance what questions were to be asked. Gargan was shocked when he later learned about the meeting Stephen Smith and Jack Miller had held with Bernie Flynn of the District Attorney's Office. It was the kind of overkill that perhaps took place as a result of people trying to protect not only Ted Kennedy, but the Kennedy image, the record, and the reputation. Gargan said, they were going through an enormous effort and extent to do that. And in their enthusiasm, I'm afraid some people overreacted and did things that were unnecessary. In Gargan's opinion, Ted Kennedy could have handled the inquest questions. He didn't need that kind of help, Gargan said. Unfortunately, a lot of people aren't going to believe Paul Markham and I were not familiarized with that situation when we testified. But we were not. Chapter 51. Collecting as many signatures of inquest participants as he could, Assistant District Attorney Peter Gay asked Paul Markham to autograph his copy of The Bridge of Chappaquiddick. Markham wrote in it, "Don't believe everything you read." Because Markham's examination had been left to Armand Fernandez, rumors circulated through the press corps that Denise had quit the inquest. Denise showed up at the communications center with assurances, "I'm still on the case. I'm not leaving." He didn't know what all the commotion was about, but I'm going to find out. Denise traced the rumor to Dick Drane, the senator's press secretary. Drane had told reporters, "Denise is folding up. He's leaving and not coming back." State Police Captain Charles Harrington, in charge of courthouse security, had told Drane he thought the district attorney was leaving the island that afternoon. Denise was uncharacteristically subdued at the communications center. "I've led a very controversial life. I keep hoping the controversy will leave me, but it won't," he told reporters. "I just do the best I can." Far from being relentless in the pursuit of a criminal case against Ted Kennedy, Denise said he expected to vote for him in November, if he's renominated. Taking his lead from Denise, Armand Fernandez was not aggressive in his questioning of witnesses either. He did ask Markham about the victory party after the regatta race, eliciting the laconic reply, "People were drinking several cans of beer." But Fernandez failed to question the host about the party when Ross Richards took the witness stand. Instead, Fernandez confined his questioning of Richards to events the morning after the accident. Richards had spent half an hour in Senator Kennedy's company on the deck of the Shiretown Inn, talking about the previous day's race. He had observed no injuries or anything out of the ordinary about Kennedy's speech, appearance, or attitude. "There wasn't a word mentioned about Chappaquiddick," he said. Markham and Gargan had appeared ruffled when they arrived. "I would say they looked damp. Their hair hadn't been combed in some time," Richard said. "They might have been wet from the night's dew or fog or something." Richards denied telling a detective from the district attorney's office both men had been soaking wet. He said, "I did not say that, I'm sure." Fernandez wanted to refresh Richards' recollection by reading from Lieutenant John Dunn's report of his interrogation, but Boyle wouldn't allow it. Fernandez didn't question auto dealer Stan Moore, because he had nothing to add to Richards' testimony. Moore expected to testify, because I'd been with Ted on Ross's boat and at the Shiretown Inn the next morning. All inquest witnesses were being kept in a large room on the second floor of the courthouse, adjacent to the courtroom. When it was somebody's turn, a court officer came in and got them. Moore observed the boiler room girls playing cards, shooting the breeze, and laughing. They seemed lighthearted, a bit nervous maybe, but not real anxious about testifying. Moore was pondering how he would get around telling the inquest about the highballs Ted Kennedy had enjoyed on Ross Richards' boat when he was excused. Moore and Richards left the courthouse together to share a chartered flight to Hyannis. Moore noticed he was being followed, presumably by members of the press, and ducked into his automobile agency to switch cars. Then he headed for Hyannisport. Richards wanted to say hello to Ted Kennedy. When Richards knocked on his door, Kennedy opened it himself and thanked him for testifying, Moore recalled. "We were on Ted's doorstep 2-3 minutes at the most. It was a sunny day, but very cold. Ross was very offended Ted didn't ask him in. He'd come all the way from Florida and hired an attorney. He'd spent time and money to make sure Ted didn't get bagged for drunk driving. And all the thanks he got was a fast brush-off." Killen hit the ceiling when he learned Moore had been excused from testifying at the inquest. Killen wanted to find out if Moore would refuse under oath to discuss the drinking that went on regatta day, as he repeatedly had done during police interrogation. The decision not to put Moore on the stand had been made by Denise, Fernandez said later. Both Richards and Moore had refused to talk to police about drinking. It was obvious they were protecting Ted Kennedy. There was no reason to believe they wouldn't do the same thing on the witness stand. That's why Moore wasn't called. As the second day of the inquest neared an end, the first of the boiler room girls was called to testify. Other witnesses could follow the script of the senator's testimony without difficulty. Esther Newberg had to square hers with a number of interviews she'd granted the week after the accident. In those interviews, she had gone on record as saying, "No one specifically missed Senator Kennedy or Mary Jo Kopechne or noticed what time they left the party." She had described as an informal group with no one keeping particular track of who was there and who wasn't at any given time. But the time element had become crucial to shoring up Kennedy's version of the accident. Now, under oath, 5 months after the accident, Newberg managed to remember that Kennedy had left the party at 11:30 p.m. "I have a rather large watch I wear all the time, and I looked at it," she said on the witness stand. "I saw him walk out of the screen door. Miss Kopechne was directly behind him." Mary Jo had appeared completely sober. "If you can use me as an expert. If I tell you that Mary Jo's blood had a content of 0.9 per 100% of alcohol, which, by expert testimony, would be somewhere between 5 or 6 drinks, would this change your testimony in any respect?" Boyle asked. "Mary Jo was not a drinker," Newberg said. 5 or 6 drinks would have been completely out of order with the way she lived. "I am only telling you what a chemical analysis shows," Boyle said, ruffled by the stridency of the witness. "And the chemical analysis is practically irrefutable. Then I'm the wrong person to be asked, Newberg replied sharply, because as far as I was concerned, she was completely sober. And you saw her the time she left, Boyle said. Exactly the time she left, she shot back. But Newberg didn't know where Mary Jo was going when she left the cottage. She overheard Gargan tell the Lyons sisters something to the effect that the senator swam across. Perhaps in my own mind I then assumed that Mary Jo was back at the motel. Boyle wasn't buying it. How did you believe Miss Kopechne got back to the motel? She had driven the black car back. They had left before midnight, so I knew they could make a ferry without any trouble. She had driven and he swam, Boyle said incredulously. Nothing is said by her to you or anyone else as to where she is going. Now you make an assumption that she is going back to the motel? Newberg assumed Mary Jo was going into the front yard. Later, I had the assumption that it was a long day watching that race. She was exhausted, and the senator was probably driving her back to the motel so that she could get some rest. Without her saying a single word to you or to anyone else at the party, Boyle said, aroused from complacency on the bench to challenge, for the first time, a witness's testimony at the inquest. That is right, Newberg said. At that time, you and the other girls were expecting to go back to your motel. Didn't somebody walk out and see two motor vehicles gone? Boyle asked. Suddenly, you are left without transportation on an island, and none of you girls said, what are we going to do? What is happening? This isn't the plan. No questions of any kind are discussed among you.
There was some concern about whether we could make the ferry, Newberg said. After 1 o'clock, we realized we weren't going to go back that night. Something was said, we have to make the best of a bad situation and attempt to sleep. We had no reason to be unduly alarmed. We knew that if we had to stay that night at the island, nothing was going to happen.
You could think of no reason why two men should leave and take the last transportation available without saying a single word to you, not even a by your leave, Boyle said acidly. That didn't excite you at all?
We all wondered where Mr. Gargan and Mr. Markham went, Newberg responded. Nobody volunteered any information. Later, when Mr. Gargan said the senator swam across, it was almost as if we didn't need to know. He didn't seem to want to talk in detail about what happened. By that time, we couldn't get off the island anyway. And we assumed that Mary Jo was back in that motel room.
The most argumentative of witnesses, Newberg had won the sympathy of Armand Fernandez. She seemed like a nice girl put in a tough position, he said. It was obvious Boyle had taken a dislike to her. Dislike or not, Boyle had no intention of letting her off the hook. Did you at any time have any interview or conversation with any reporters?
Newberg braced herself for what was coming. The last time was the week of the accident, the day after the funeral, she said. I was in a state of extreme duress.
But Boyle wasn't referring to those interviews, but a report published in December.
No, I'm sorry, Newberg said. I can see what you are reading from. That looks like one of the trash sheets like the National Enquirer. I never talked to that reporter. I never talked to anyone after July.
Because neither Boyle nor Denise had done a background on the witness, including reading the July interviews Newberg had given to the New York Times and other newspapers, Boyle could press her no further. Confronted much later with the contradictions between her interviews and inquest testimony, Newberg said it was unfair to pinpoint conflicts.
Because, Christ, I can't remember what I told a Worcester Mass reporter 5 years ago.
Since the boiler room was lodged together, Boyle specifically ordered Newberg not to discuss any portion of your testimony with any of them. Newberg didn't have to worry about disobeying Boyle's instructions. Paul Redman did it for her. If Boyle was going to question his other clients as searchingly as he had Newberg, Redman wanted them prepared. Warnings about witnesses disclosing testimony be damned. If Boyle wanted discussion among the young women at the party as to what was going on, Redman was happy to supply it through the testimony of Mary Ellen and Nance Lyons. When Markham and Gargan had returned to the cottage around 2:30 to 2:45 a.m., they'd been asked, "Where have you been? What is going on? What is happening?"
They stated that they had gone with the senator to the ferry, and the ferry wasn't there, Nance Lyons said. They said they couldn't find a boat, and the senator dove in and swam across, that Miss Kopechne had taken the car to the Katama shores.
Didn't you say to them, well, how come Mary Jo takes the car and the senator swims? Boyle said. Did you have some thoughts in your mind that this was most peculiar?
No, not really, Mary Ellen Lyons answered. We weren't asking anything because there was no reason to, Mary Ellen said. We were just saying, where is everybody? The only thing we could think of was that a car was stuck in the sand.
Mary Ellen had noticed Senator Kennedy and Mary Jo Kopechne were not at the cottage around 11:15 p.m. or 11:30 p.m. Just after a while, they weren't there. Nance Lyons gave a similar account. She had seen the senator and Mary Jo walk out the door of the cottage. Although she wasn't wearing a watch, I would say it was 11 o'clock p.m., 11:15 p.m. It hadn't registered they were leaving the party permanently, simply because people were moving in and out of the cottage all evening. An hour later, Ray LaRosa came in from outside and said in a rather loud voice, because people were talking, Mr. Gargan, Mr. Markham, Senator Kennedy would like to see you. She added that LaRosa told her during the walk she and Mary Ellen had taken with him that the senator had returned to the cottage. Susan Tannenbaum followed the Lyons sisters to the stand. She'd seen Mary Jo, but not Senator Kennedy, leave the party. She'd looked at her watch at 11:25, and Mary Jo had already left.
Were you surprised, Boyle asked, to find out that, without your knowledge, all the transportation had gone so you couldn't get back to Edgartown?
Yes, I was surprised, Tannenbaum said.
Was there not some discussion between you and your friends about it? No one said, well, gee, this is unusual to leave us stranded here?
Not that I remember, Tannenbaum said.
You are not accustomed to being deserted in that fashion, are you? Boyle said with obvious irony.
It was a question without an answer, but Boyle had made his point. A pattern of collusion in the testimony of the young women, all of it clearly aimed at corroborating the time Senator Kennedy claimed he had left the party.
Exasperated, Boyle dismissed the witness. He said, you may leave the courtroom and go, I assume, right to your friends.
The prettiest of the boiler room girls, Tannenbaum was as unhappy about her testimony as Boyle was. Her participation in the inquest continued to rankle. A year later, she demanded of Joe Gargan, would you just do anything the senator asked you to do? As Gargan read her question, Tannenbaum was insinuating that I may have been either put in the position or that I did whatever had to be done under the circumstances to protect Ted Kennedy. What she was asking was whether I would sacrifice my own reputation and career to protect Ted Kennedy. Gargan gave her an honest answer.
If you mean the time of Chappaquiddick, no, I would not, he said. I didn't do it then, and I wouldn't do it now.
The transcript of Kennedy witnesses completed with the testimony of the boiler room girls, court stenographer Joe Donegan was free to enjoy the social aspects of his assignment, having a few drinks at night after dinner, and a surprise birthday party for Judge Clark. That was a lot of fun.
That's the only time I saw Jack Miller at the house on School Street, Paul Redmond recalled. Jack was at the party. Clarky was deeply touched, really moved. He was a super guy. An old-style barrister, and a great storyteller. I used to say to him he should be in Hollywood, Donegan said, because he was more of an actor than anything else. That's how he tried his cases. He'd put on a long face and act everything out to the jury. It was very effective.
Clark's performance at the inquest had occurred offstage. He had more to celebrate than his birthday. No Kennedy witnesses had departed from the official Kennedy line. Nor was the omnipresent press the wiser. Walking with Clark one afternoon, some of the newspaper people asked what connection I had with the case, Donegan recalled. They were curious about everybody. But no reporter ever came to the house on School Street. The population of reporters in Edgartown had dropped to half after Senator Kennedy's inquest appearance. For New York Times columnist James Reston, newsmen left in frustration over a non-story. Held behind closed doors,
to repeat old tales which few people quite believe anyway. Seldom in the wonderful, goofy history of politics and the press have so many reporters and so much expensive gear been transferred at such cost to cover so little news as the current Kennedy inquiry. Reston lived next door to the house on School Street. Like other newsmen, however, he never discovered the inquest was being managed by Jack Miller from a script crafted by Kennedy lawyers and transcribed by Joe Donegan. Susan Tannenbaum's testimony made the crucial time factor unanimous. Every boiler room girl had seen Senator Kennedy and Mary Jo Kopechne leave the party between 11 o'clock and 11:30 p.m. A remarkable display of unanimity for those whose memories had lapsed about any other event at the party. But such multiple endorsements had been required to support the senator's accident time, and to overwhelm Huck Look's anticipated testimony by a sheer weight of numbers. Chapter 52. To corroborate Kennedy's version of the accident, witnesses had to know what they could not know. Where the senator had gone after leaving the party. Esther Newberg conceded, "The real story is what went on in that car and what went on during the next 8 hours, and I have no knowledge of anything in that period." Neither did anybody else. But one man believed he knew something about the missing hours that no one else did. Taking the witness stand on Wednesday, the third day of the inquest, Huck Look repeated testimony he had given at the exhumation hearing at Wilkes Bar. A dark car with an L7 license plate had passed in front of him at the intersection of Dyke and Chappaquiddick Road in the early morning hours of July 19th. Boyle wanted Look to be more specific than a dark car. The vehicle was either black, deep blue, or dark green, Look said. "Then you are unable to positively identify this car you saw taken out of the water as the identical car you saw the previous night," Boyle asked. "No, I can't," Look answered. Despite his challenge to Look's testimony, Boyle also took steps to corroborate it. The district attorney's office had not conducted an investigation through the Registry of Motor Vehicles to determine how many cars in Massachusetts had registration plates with L7 configurations. "Maybe no other car happens to have that combination, or is a Volkswagen, I don't know," Boyle said. But he thought the information so important, "I will even postpone the inquest, in order that an investigation be made." But a recess was not necessary. Fernandez told Boyle, "I will get on it with Lieutenant Killen right away." Killen assigned Bernie Flynn the task. "It was like 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday afternoon when I called the registry," Flynn recalled. "I got some assistant in McLaughlin's office. I gave him the information I wanted, and a number at the state police barracks at Oak Bluffs where he could be reached." The registry was already on the defensive. Registrar McLaughlin had told Arthur Egan of the Manchester Union Leader that Senator Kennedy's license showed no traces of salt water, raising serious questions about Kennedy's testimony. Kennedy's office hadn't been discussing details of the case outside court. "And we aren't going to now," a spokesman said. "However, if the Union Leader's story is an attempt to allege that the senator was not in the car when it went into the water, we would refer that newspaper to the senator's comment on the Jack Olson theory that Miss Kopechne was driving alone. Nonsense." McLaughlin denied he'd spoken to Egan or anyone else at the Union Leader. "It would be improper for me to talk to anyone on the subject until the case has been adjudicated." He couldn't speculate on whether the license had been in the water or not. McLaughlin changed his story when the full realization of the important information he'd supplied hit him later in the day. Egan charged and produced a letter from the New England Telephone Company, verifying 2 person-to-person calls completed to McLaughlin's office on Tuesday, January 6th. McLaughlin continued to insist he hadn't received the calls. "And I don't believe anyone else did who would have access to the license," he said. The Associated Press declined to circulate the story because it's not news when a newspaper catches a prominent official in a barefaced lie. The day after denying he talked to Egan, McLaughlin was reappointed registrar. Republican Governor Francis Sargent was not doing so out of political considerations, he said. How he votes is his own concern. How he functions as registrar is mine. And on that basis, I make the reappointment with satisfaction. Not everyone agreed. The New Bedford Standard Times scorned the appointment as a payoff and an open acknowledgement of McLaughlin's influence in the Democratic-dominated legislature, with which Governor Sargent must do business. McLaughlin's agency was so maladministered. Police have first-hand experience with the frustration of trying to extract, when most needed, quick information on the ownership of motor vehicles from the registry's muddled files. But Flynn had no trouble receiving the very next morning a list of L7 license plate owners from Carl Catalano, chief of the registry's special investigations. Only 8 of the 50 plates had been issued to operators of Oldsmobile-type vehicles. Flynn called automobile owners on the list and asked, "Was your car on Chappaquiddick on the night of July 18th?" None had been. Flynn turned the results of his investigation over to Killen. Though the results seemed to prove conclusively that the car Hucklook saw had to be the one Ted Kennedy was driving, Flynn learned later that the evidence was not used at the inquest. "I don't know what the reason was, whether it came in too late or what," Flynn said. Fernandez had a different explanation. Boyle had decided such an investigation would not be conclusive, and so he wasn't interested in knowing the findings. But Boyle himself later revealed, "The attempt disclosed that it would not be feasible to do this, since there would be no assurance that the end result would be helpful." While the elimination of all other cars within that registration group would seriously affect the credibility of some of the witnesses, Boyle said, it wouldn't alter his findings. Flynn's detective work was not the only registry evidence kept out of the record of the inquest. 3 registry inspectors en route to the inquest on Thursday morning to testify about the license plate investigation were told they weren't needed. Not that the registry itself was entirely forthcoming in producing evidence either, as was demonstrated when George "Red" Kennedy took the witness stand. Kennedy's report of the accident had been kept out of the hands of the district attorney's office until Fernandez formally requested a copy of it on December 15th, 2 weeks before the start of the inquest. When Senator Kennedy had been unable to produce a driver's license at Edgartown Police Station, a check at registry headquarters had revealed his license was valid until February 1971, Inspector Kennedy said on the witness stand. This was the same day, on the 19th. With the report of 2 license checks in hand, Fernandez was surprised the witness was prepared to lie under oath. He gave Kennedy another chance. Did they produce the license immediately? Realizing he'd been caught in the lie, Kennedy changed the testimony. The license was produced, he said, at another date. Inspector Kennedy's remaining testimony was equally questionable. Based upon the measurement of skid marks at the start of the bridge, continuing in a straight line to the end and over, and his experience investigating more than 100 accidents, Kennedy was of the opinion the accident car was traveling approximately 20 to 22 miles per hour, corroborating the senator's estimated rate of speed in his operator's report. Skid marks on the gravel surface of Dyke Road preceding the bridge, however, could not be measured very well, Kennedy said. Boyle broke in to cut off his line of questioning. "Now you are going into something that may not exist." Fernandez protested. "He doesn't know." Because skid marks on Dyke Road couldn't be measured didn't mean there weren't any. If Senator Kennedy had started braking before he hit the bridge, he could have been going much faster than 20 miles per hour when the accident occurred. To Fernandez, it was an important point, because it cast doubt on the inspector's report. The registry's official rate of speed prior to the accident was based on partial and inconclusive evidence. There was a significant difference between not being able to measure skid marks on gravel and saying there weren't any. "Let's ignore that," Boyle said. He wanted no conjecture on the record. But conjecture did not prevent Boyle from allowing the Arthur D. Little study of the physical factors of the accident into evidence. Boyle refused to consider those portions of the study dealing with experiments conducted with regard to Mary Jo Kopechne's possible longevity underwater. He was not concerned with the problem of survival in an immersed automobile. Since there was no evidence that any air had remained in the car, testimony was not sought nor allowed concerning how long Mary Jo Kopechne might have lived had such a condition existed.